Hey folks, welcome to the shot with Cosmos with Cosmos. And today, here's to Hipparchus.
Hey, the
first space astrometry mission. And we're doing these with anti-shot glasses because the last time we tried doing this, the mics were muted. So here we go, round two.
Woo!
Good shot.
I thought we weren't going to say that.
Well, we did now. So I just
went for it. So in any case, so the space mission itself was launched in 1989. And its stated mission, my best Kirk voice, pinpoint the stars, their motion and distance. And this totally European mission mapped the heavens more accurately than ever before.
To boldly map the stars.
Ooh, I like that. Okay. And in fact, Kirk and the Enterprise could not exist without this mission and without the guy we're going to talk about as well. Because you can't, go to the stars. We don't know where they're at.
That is a very fair point. Yeah.
So starting from the top, you get lost in space. Boom. Hey, nice. So astrometry, in short, is the position and specific locations of celestial objects within the galaxy. This is useful for distance and the motion of the heavens. So think about as stars move through time. It helps determine parallax, exoplanet detections, and all sorts of useful stuff.
So basically where shit is in space.
Exactly. The Google Maps, if you will.
Hey.
Of space.
Except better.
Made earlier, too. All right. Anyway. So historically, astrometry was a popular field of science. It goes all the way back to Hipparchus of Nice, as he was figuring this out back in 147 BCE.
Damn.
Now, Hipparchus,
a long time ago.
It was.
Long time ago.
But in this galaxy, not very far away.
No.
So Hipparchus was known as the founder of trigonometry and discoverer of the precession of the equinoxes. And he's most known, really, as the greatest astronomical observer of the ancient world, and made the first comprehensive star catalog.
Damn.
And this catalog would later be incorporated into Ptolemy's famous Almagest.
Nice.
And so that catalog, Ptolemy, was, what do you want to call this? Like a conglomeration of lots of different catalogs, but it was like the most comprehensive as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Hipparchus's catalog, fun fact, was discovered in 2022 again.
Damn. I mean, that's crazy that it went lost. Like, it just, they only found bits and pieces in other works, and then they finally were like, hey, here's a copy.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. Like,
can you imagine the person who found it, though?
I guess if you're that level of researcher, you kind of know what you're looking at.
It's just Gandalf in the library.
take a drink. So in any case, yeah, they were looking at this manuscript from medieval times, and they found that Hipparchus's coordinates were within 1 degree of the real position.
Holy shit.
That's insanely close.
That's amazing that how spot on he pretty much was.
Yeah, and he's not working with a telescope here. He's just looking at it and going, yeah, right about there.
I mean, that's how good the night sky was without light pollution.
That's also true.
Yeah, but he also did have instruments he was using. I'm sure.
But not like a tele... Yeah,
he's yeah like, but not like, yeah.
Yeah.
So he did have instruments, and you can see them on different websites. And it's like this, I don't know, circular object to kind of use to position center objects. So it was something, at least. But in any case, Hipparchus himself was just kind of a chill dude. He enthusiastically made changes to his own theories when somebody pointed out errors.
Oh my God, think of that.
Looking out to that. So he's just kind of worth looking into. All right, so after a long time, after Hipparchus, Ptolemy, Tycho Brahe, Laplace, William Herschel, all these people, looking into astrometry, kind of took a backseat in the 20th century because we got huge, fantastic instruments that we could focus on, like black holes, nebulae, supernovae, galaxies, quasars, and all the really cool space stuff. So astrometry itself kind of fell out of vogue.
Oh, hey. Okay.
Enter Pierre Lacroix, I think. In 1967, with all these rockets going up in space in the midst of the space race, he proposed, and this will sound familiar, putting a telescope above the annoying atmosphere of the Earth to better measure the distance of the stars.
Sounds like a bad idea. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, never going to work.
They're never
going to get the measurements right in the mirror anyway. So his reasoning is that knowing the distance and motions of stars would help understand their evolution, better understand solar systems, and ultimately help find planets and life just by knowing where the stars are at in the sky.
I mean, that would help.
Yeah. So at this time, France's Center for Space Studies, they agreed. And for about a decade, they pursued creating a space telescope. But in 1980, costs were skyrocketing, of course, because space telescope hasn't really happened much
at
all at that point. And France then took the idea to the European Space Agency, who agreed to finance the project.
Oh, go Europe.
Right. And so Hipparchus itself, the telescope, was a Schmidt optical telescope. And this was for the wide field of view it allows. And so, for example, the Kepler Space Telescope used the same kind of mirror for that field of view, so that way it could, you know, check out all different stars at once, as opposed to individual sections.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, in fact, Hipparchus's optical telescopes were designed to be so accurate that if the telescope itself was expanded to the size of the Atlantic Ocean, the small bumps on the surface would only be 10 centimeters high.
Ooh. Wow.
That's how smooth this thing is.
Oh my god.
That's really good. Yeah. That's really good.
But before we can do that, of course, you gotta get a telescope into space. Mm-hmm. And enter the Ariane 4 rocket, which of course is a weird name for it. But anyway, this rocket.
Change the name of the rocket.
It was chosen to launch at French Guinea, the same site as James Webb would later launch from. And that rocket was historically a workhorse. It successfully launched 113 times out of 116 launches. So it came a bit of a surprise when one of the boosters failed during the launch.
Oh, no.
So Hipparchus actually failed to reach its intended geosynchronous orbits. But it was not lost because the ESA, European Space Agency ground controllers, managed to put our Intrepid telescope into a geostationary transfer orbit. All right, so some orbital dynamics here.
Oh, okay. Oh, God.
So usually, this type of orbit, geostationary transfer, is a stepping stone to geosynchronous. And geosynchronous, kind of like if you pick apart its name, geo and synchronous, means it orbits at the same rate as the Earth spins. So it's always over one spot of the planet.
Okay.
The transfer orbit, however, is an elliptical orbit. So as opposed to a nice circle, like the orbits of the planets around the sun, it's elongated like an oval, getting closer and farther away from the Earth as it goes.
Okay.
And typically, it's a stepping stone to geosynchronous, being at one spot around the Earth. And the stationary orbit isn't that great because it routinely goes through the Van Allen belts.
Radiation.
So, yeah, that's exactly right. The Van Allen belt, it's just an area around the Earth where the magnetosphere captures charged particles from the sun. And in doing so, that section around the Earth has an immense amount of radiation. So you don't want to spend too much time in the area, especially if you have electronics or life. And... unfortunately, that's exactly what Hipparchus was destined for. It's basically live in his Van Allen belt. But the spacecraft, well, it was designed quite well. The solar panels were able to survive in that treacherous zone of radiation. So that little maneuver of putting it into this new orbit saved the telescope and let the real science begin.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Science. Yay. Engineering. Hooray. For the dynamics. Excellence.
Hip, hip, Hipparchus.
Nicely done. So this telescope cataloged two sets of stars. Okay. The first set had about 118,000 stars with extremely high accuracy, and another 1,058,000 stars with, quote, lesser but still unprecedented accuracy.
Wow.
And it can achieve these two different focal points, really, because that's what you're doing here, with a 1.4-meter beam-combining mirror. So what that meant is we have just one mirror, which is what telescopes are. They gather light. They're giant light buckets. Mm-hmm. And two different fields of view were created with slits separated by 58 degrees. So kind of just a little distance away from each other.
Okay.
So it's like looking at a light pole, standing on Earth, looking at a light pole, then walking a few paces away and looking at the same light pole. Oh. Different points of view. Hey,
yeah,
look at this.
Hey.
Then using 2,688 transparent slits, the images would become highly modulated from both points of view. So that's how you got two field of views on one primary mirror. Hooray!
Smart people.
Say lucky guess.
No, right? I said smart people.
Oh, smart people.
So that telescope ended up sending a million bits of data back to Earth, which at the time was the biggest computation in the history of astronomy.
Oh, wow. Cool. Wow.
It would go on to confirm Einstein's prediction of the effect of gravity on starlights, but found out the Milky Way is changing shape and helped predict the impact of Shoemaker-Levy 9 on Jupiter. It also altered cosmic distance scale. So this made calculations for the universe to be both bigger and younger than previously thought.
Oh, dang.
So it wasn't just plotting where the stars are in the sky. It did all this other science as well.
It's doing, like, cosmology almost, you know?
Yeah. So the final calculations were sent back to Earth in 1993 before the telescope's end, and the data evaluation was completed in 1997, and since then, several thousand scientific papers have been published using data collected from this telescope.
Holy shit.
Wow.
It completed every objective and then some. So, here's to you, you incredibly successful telescope, you.
Cheers.
Follow us on all the things.
Bye.